I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today on Smart City, we'll talk about two exciting ways schools are connecting with communities. Brian Schultz is someone you need to know. Brian was a teacher at the Bird Academy in Chicago, a public school for Chicago's notorious Cabrini-Green housing project. We'll hear about how his unconventional approach to teaching gave the students a new way to learn and an opportunity to change their school for the better. And we'll speak with Steve Barlow. He's the executive director of the University Neighborhoods Development Corporation in Memphis. Steve is working with the University of Memphis and a wide variety of public and private organizations to help the university participate in the life of its surrounding neighborhoods. All this plus Plan Edison's Nate Berg and City View's commentator Walker Smith today on Smart City. Right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Brian Schultz was working in the corporate world doing education consulting, but found it dissatisfying. So after getting his master's degree in elementary education, he came to the Richard E. Byrd Community Academy in Chicago's notorious Cabrini-Green housing project. Once there, he developed a unique curriculum called Project Citizen. The project taught civic engagement alongside the fundamentals, and he made it a class project to revitalize the school's decrepit classrooms. He's written a book about what he taught and what the experience taught him called Spectacular Things Happen Along the Way. Tell me about the school itself. What were the students like? What neighborhood is the school in? I mean, describe the school environment.
The school serves the Cabrini-Green housing project. So many people know Cabrini-Green because its reputation precedes it, known for misery and mayhem, underground economies, gang banging and murder, all those ways that the media portrays public housing in this country. And so the students all came from this neighborhood, from this housing project community. They were 100% African American, and the school building itself, Byrd Community Academy, was a travesty. It was falling apart. It was only 44 years old, but it was in a shameful state. Heat didn't make it to the fourth floor of the building where our classroom was. Natural light couldn't enter the opaque windows that were pocketed with bullet holes. Bathrooms didn't have stalls on the doors. Toilets didn't flush. Water leaked out of the sinks. There was no soap or paper towels in the bathrooms. So it was a pretty nasty place for what was supposed to be a learning environment, touted as a place where no child would be left behind. I'm not so sure about that.
So you came to the school as a teacher, and you decided you were going to do something very different with their learning based on the experiential learning that you had experienced yourself. So it was your idea for the project. Describe the project that you eventually undertook with the students.
It wasn't so easy. You make it sound like it was the snap of the fingers. I came in with this agenda, this idea that I wanted to teach in these experiential ways. But when I actually first came into the school, I had this democratic, progressive vision of what the classroom could be. But I realized that it wasn't going to be so easy, and teaching was much more complex than I had ever anticipated. And so all these creative ideals that I had were quickly stopped as the students pushed my buttons, wondering if I had what it took to endure life at Byrd Academy. And rightfully so. The year before, the students had had four different teachers in one school year. And so they were right to try to test me and question whether I was going to stick around. That said, I still tried to come up with different ways of reaching the students in ways that weren't so much focused on the decontextualized curriculum that was focused on rote and memorization, where the teacher was a keeper of knowledge that was going to fill the kids' heads with all sorts of useless facts, essentially, would then be measured by a high-stakes test. I wanted to actually look to the students for creating the curriculum. And so this particular classroom year, I asked the students what were problems in the community they wanted to solve. Within an hour's time, they came up with almost 100 different issues that affected them. Everything from teenage pregnancy to litter in the park to wanting a kid president. They came up with all sorts of different ideas, but when they looked at their list, they realized that about 40 of the different problems that they had mentioned all had to do with that shameful state of the school building. What I had recognized when I first walked into Byrd Academy, they had lived this injustice their entire school-age lives, and they knew the problems well.
So how long did it take you to get this project underway? You came to the school, the students challenged you.
you had this vision, they made the list, and so what happens?
For an entire year, I really did a lot of trial and error and tried to figure out what teaching was all about. Although I thought I had a philosophy of education, it certainly got muddled along the way as I worked with students. And so the beginning of my second year of teaching, I was experimenting with all sorts of different ideas about what the classroom could be. And it wasn't until December of that school year that I actually asked that question about what the problems were in the community. And so that's where the starting point of this curriculum began, and the journey continued for the remainder of the school year. Solving this problem they identified of the school building being inadequate and wanting a new school building for the community was something that we worked towards, and the entire curriculum rolled into solving this problem. So no longer was it 10 o'clock and time for math, put your reading away. It was actually an integrated curriculum that emerged from the students' interest. That question, that initial problem that they had identified, became the centerpiece for the entire curriculum for the remainder of the year.
That must have taken an enormous amount of energy on your part to take math and adapt it to this problem, to take history and adapt it to this problem, or all the things that one was required to teach fifth graders. How did you do that?
A lot of the energy came from the students. They came in early, they left late, they came in on their days off because they were solving a problem that was relevant and important to them. So no longer was school so separated from their interests, their wants, their needs, and their desires. School was all about them. A lot of the ideas of rolling math into this project happened naturally. The students at one point wanted them pizza things. I had no idea what this one particular student was talking about. It turns out another student identified that he was talking about pie charts. Well, why did they want pie charts? Well, they thought that pie charts would be something that could prove things. They proved things in the newspaper. They could rally others to support their cause of needing a new school building. So at that point, they went out and surveyed the broader community to find out what the issues were with the school, whether other people supported getting a new school building for the community. And so then all of a sudden we had all this data that we needed to not only aggregate, but we needed to analyze. And so the students did that. They actually came up with ways to enter their data into a software program, then to analyze it. And so no longer was I teaching chapter 10 in the math book about mean, median, and mode. Now it was about the students making sense of the data that they owned in a way. They actually had not only created the prompts, the questions for this survey, but they had actually gone out and collected it, and now we're processing it. It was something that I didn't necessarily had to fight to have happen. It was something that the students wanted to do. And so those subject areas, the only place that we actually divide the world into subject areas is school, right? Like we don't say, oh, it's time for social studies. Now let's, you know, and then let's do reading. That just doesn't happen. So the students recognized this, not because they were trying to do this progressive educational ideal, but because they were trying to work at solving a problem with an authentic audience. And I think that authenticity is really important because those standards of excellence, all those things in the hyper-accountability craze that we hear in schools today, were naturally met with rigor because they were talking with legislators, they were testifying at the State Board of Education, they were doing all sorts of things that needed to have writing skills. All those sorts of standards were rolled into this curriculum, not because I was necessarily trying to force it to happen, but because it happened in fluid ways.
They decided their goal would be to build a new school. That's a pretty audacious goal for fifth graders. What made them think they could accomplish this?
There actually had been a new school building promised to the Cabrini-Green community about 6 years earlier. The planning for the new school building had been done. The ground had been raised. There was a sign proclaiming a new bird school just adjacent to the land that the current school was on. So much planning had been done that architectural drawings and renderings were in the school office. The color of the tile and the types of window treatments were actually even selected. And so the students realized that not only did they have a shameful school, but they knew that something had been promised. There was an erstwhile promise that hadn't come through from the city of Chicago and the Chicago Board of Education, and they wanted to make those decision makers make good on their promise. And so I think that that's where they latched on to the opportunity to get a new school building. And then also I think that it was the type of classroom that was constructed, where they had the space, the opportunity, and the responsibility to create their own learning and to ask their own questions. And so as they were asking questions about what it takes to get a new school building, they were actually able to do the research to figure out ways to actually try to work to solve this problem. So I was not necessarily saying, oh, that sounds good, but that seems like too big of a deal. No, they actually had that opportunity, and I was there to support them in every which way I could.
Okay, so you start this project in December of a school year. You've got half a school year left. What can fifth graders get done, even with a big idea and even with a plan, what can they get done in 6 months?
It wasn't just identifying the problem, but they actually analyzed and researched alternative solutions and set their goal on getting a new school building and had contingent action planning. And this action plan that they developed had six parts to it in the beginning. The first wave of ideas was about letter writing and sending emails to people they thought could help their cause. They talked about going on strike. They talked about petitioning. They enacted these parts. And then as they engaged in this problem solving and working towards their action plan, they realized that they needed it to grow. So they decided to produce a video documentary. They developed a website and produced a DVD, all in the aim of rallying people to support their cause and getting the word out, as they called it.
It's really amazing. So by the end of the school year, what had they accomplished?
All sorts of things had happened. In terms of seeing changes in the school, one of the alternatives that they had focused on was seeing remedy and repair, not just to get a new school building. And so everything from soap and paper towels in the bathrooms to the entire school getting new windows, were things that they had seen changed. Our classroom saw new lights. There were new doors on the building for security purposes, one of the things that the students had identified. And so all sorts of things were gaining traction in terms of them solving the problem. And also they were getting a huge response from legislators, whether it was local legislators visiting the school or getting a national audience to respond, whether it was Vice President Dick Cheney responding and establishing a case at the Department of Education to see through that the problems that the students had identified were getting remedied, were getting fixed, because nobody should be going to a school in a state that the kids at Byrd were having to experience and endure.
So they embarrassed someone.
Well, there's certainly egg on the face of a lot of people, although those decision makers at the Board of Education and the City of Chicago never responded to the students directly. So the students would send emails and letters on a daily basis and would call down to the Board of Education's top brass, and they wouldn't get a response. They would essentially be ignored, and it was kind of that mantra, if you ignore the problem, it just doesn't exist. Although there were remedies going on, so somebody was listening, yet they weren't necessarily giving the respect to the students themselves. And so there was that tenuous moment in the classroom often where how could these people, for instance, a columnist at the Chicago Tribune, get the attention of the chief executive officer of Chicago Public Schools, but he keeps on ignoring us? Or why won't he come and visit if he's the head of the schools? Why is he ignoring us if that's what he does? Why can't he just come for a visit? It doesn't make sense to us.
Did the principal feel in a bind?
Well, certainly. I think that the principal wanted to support this project in many ways. In some interesting ways, the students were giving and lending a voice to him. He had certainly wanted the new school. And so there was this counter-narrative going on where fifth graders from the notorious and infamous Cabrini-Green were lending a voice to an administrator that had been within the system for years. And so I think that there was some concern that the principal had, but at the same time, he also witnessed firsthand what was happening in the classroom and saw the students transformed, not only by their attendance, but by their performance on traditional measures like test scores and the like. So their test scores were through the roof, their attendance was through the roof, and so he couldn't do anything but support the students in their crusade to get a better learning environment for themselves.
Is a new school in the works?
No, the short answer to that is no. Unfortunately, the Chicago School Board decided to close down the Byrd Academy at the end of that school year, citing low enrollment. And those that are following the plan for transformation in the city of Chicago with the public housing, there's massive gentrification going on, and lots of the African-American families that made Cabrini-Green home have been displaced to the south and west side of the city. And so the school board cited that there was low enrollment, although over the past 10 years, there was a controlled enrollment. And since the time that I was there, it was the same amount of students the entire time. And so certainly, I think that a lot of the attention that the Room 405 students maybe hastened the closure exposure of Bird, although the students went back and researched this issue of were they the ones responsible for getting the school building closed, and found out that the school board had decided long before they actually engaged in this project to get a new school building that the school building would be closed down. But as things happen in the city of Chicago, nobody knew that. That was kind of private documentation that wasn't released until after the decision had been made.
Do you still teach in the system?
I actually teach at a university within the city. So I stayed around within Chicago Public Schools for a year. Now I work with students that would graduate from Chicago Public Schools and go on to higher education. So the mission of the university that I teach at, Northeastern Illinois University, is all about access and diversity. And so many of my former students, when they go on to college and stay within the city, will end up at universities like Northeastern Illinois.
Were teachers inspired to follow your model, and are they prepared to do so?
I think that's a great question, and certainly at the beginning, many of my colleagues questioned what was happening in the classroom. I had a very alternative way of approaching the classroom. Allowing students to follow their interests and their desires was radically different than what most teachers do in urban areas. Typically, we focus on this back-to-the-basics mantra and remediation, and although there was a vast disparity between my highest-achieving students and my struggling students, they all were really focused on wanting to solve this problem. And so we were able to get a lot accomplished in that way. There was a lot of question in the beginning from my colleagues about what was happening in the classroom. But at the same time, they were also interested. They saw what was happening in their former students or just in kids in the hallway talking about the project and wanted to learn about teaching in progressive ways. And one of the things that I really worked to do was to coach other teachers, not only during that school year, but also going into colleagues' classrooms to help them think about how they could focus on interest-based learning, how they could establish these sorts of progressive educational ideals and make them a reality in their classroom. Now, as a university professor, I work with future teachers. I teach future educators and work with practicing teachers right now and really push them to think about how to make classrooms spaces where kids can problem pose, can focus on what resonates with them most, rather than being something that's prescriptive or top down as schools typically are. And so my students that are engaged in this now find that it's not only motivating for them, but their students really resonate with it as well.
Did you manage to get what you were doing approved by the state, or did you have to get that approval, or how did it link up with state standards?
One of the things that I talk about a lot is this notion of inverting the curriculum. And so if you start with a student's interests, then that curriculum can focus on what it is that's most important to the students. And lo and behold, when you actually focus on interests, a lot of the state standards are naturally met. I'll give an example. In Illinois, for instance, the number one reading standard, the first reading standard for fifth grade, is Reads with Understanding. I don't know of a teacher anywhere, no matter what teaching style they have, no matter what kind of ideological frame they're working from, will get up in front of a classroom and say, today, class, we're going to read without understanding, right? Like, that just doesn't happen. And so it's ridiculous, right? And so how do we actually weave the standards into what we're teaching? I think that the way that I worked in this classroom, the way that I approached teaching, was all about the standards, but they weren't standards for their own sake, and that's really important. So I don't have a problem with standards at all, but the way that standards get interpreted, not only at the state level, but at the district or at a school level, is completely misguided. It doesn't take into account the teacher and the students and maybe the classroom resources and all those contextual factors that come into play when you're teaching. So if we take those into account and we actually focus on that as the beginning point of what we're doing in the classroom, lo and behold, those things that somebody else has deemed are the most important, the most worthwhile, actually are being accomplished because they're not so hard to satisfy in terms of, for instance, data analysis in math and science. That's something that happens when you actually have things to analyze. And so that was kind of happening in terms of what we were doing in the classroom, but not because it was the next chapter in our science book. It was because what we were doing had relevancy to the issue at hand.
Did the students leave the year knowing not only were they not going to get a new school, they weren't going to have the existing school that had been improved in ways that apparently they influenced. Did they walk away encouraged, discouraged, a feeling of the system just doesn't work for us, or we can make a difference. What was their overall attitude?
One of the things that I really wondered about as I was teaching and wrestled with on a daily basis, it kept me up at night. What happens if they really focus on what's important to them, they really work, they give it their all, and then they get slapped down by the system? And so I wondered about that. And so what I did was I actually took that to the students, took my concerns to the students, and it provided for a lot of democratic dialogue and debate. And we deliberated about this. And the students decided that they really wanted to focus on it, even though they knew that there was a strong possibility that the school could get closed down, that they could lose this community. Even though the school was in shambles, the school was certainly beyond the building. And the students identified that and resonated with that. And so what I focus on is this notion of process rather than product. And it's in the educational literature over the past 100 years where we should really be focusing on the means rather than the ends. And so typically the ends now are one single high stakes test. And that's absolutely ridiculous. Can't we focus on the process? Isn't the process what we actually want to do? Isn't that what we want to teach our students so they can transfer it to another situation, whether it's in school or in their lives? And so that's really what I focus on. And the students would say to this day, because I'm still in contact with most of the students, that the process and the experience was worth it. Certainly, when they found the news the last week of school that the school was going to close down, they were frustrated. One of the students said, "You've wasted my breath the entire year." But as they thought about it and as they journaled about it, and they had more resolve than I did, and they said that this sort of experience is something that all students should be able to do, that they should focus on something that matters to them rather than something that matters to the teacher or matters to the school district. And so they latched on to a lot of the key ideas that I was thinking about. It's interesting to me because recently the students presented at a national educational research conference. They were invited to New York City, and it wasn't because I had planned this. I hadn't proposed this sort of session. Somebody had heard about the work that they had been doing, and now it's almost 5 years later. They were talking to teachers and teacher educators about what it takes to motivate and engage city kids in their schooling. The students had some really key ideas about what it was that they took away from this experience, and they talked about the ideas of choice and flexibility, about getting parents involved in the classroom, about getting the community involved in the classroom and the classroom involved in the community, and the notion of letting kids ask questions that are most important to them. And so this was their key message to this audience of teachers and professors that teach teachers about how to actually get kids involved. And so for me, sitting back and saying, okay, I'm no longer their teacher, but this is the experience that they took away. They understood the power and the empowerment that this kind of choice and flexibility had is amazing to me. And so I think they've got it.
Can't thank you enough for being our guest on Smart City. This was fun.
Well, it was great for me too. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Brian Schultz is the author of Spectacular Things Happen Along the Way, his account of his innovative approach to teaching at the Richard E. Byrd Academy in Chicago. Now for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we go to PlanEdison assistant editor, Nate Berg.
Poverty is a relative term. An impoverished person in Omaha is probably in a far different situation than an impoverished person in LA. Recognizing that the specifics of place play a large role in determining such social circumstances, the city of New York has announced some changes to the way it measures poverty rates. According to an article in the New York Times, the city is planning to update its poverty measurements to include such city-specific indicators as the cost of housing, clothing, and healthcare, which are not currently covered in the federal government's formula. The city expects the new metrics to bump up the number of people reported to be in poverty from 19% to about 23%, which could eventually help direct federal funding to the people who need it the most. New York City officials hope their new system is considered by other cities, and that it will redefine the concept of poverty. Meanwhile, in Chicago, downtown may not be dead after all. Though lively during the day, the Loop, the square mile of downtown skyscrapers circled by elevated train tracks, becomes a ghost town at night. But things may be changing. The Chicago Tribune reports that the Loop is seeing a resurgence of interest, with more condominiums in development, more people moving downtown, and more shops staying open later into the night. By 2010, the downtown population is expected to reach more than 160,000. That's twice as many people than were there in 1990. Downtown leaders are hopeful that the rise in population will continue, and that Chicago's Loop can finally become more than a 9-to-5 part of the city. And finally, in Berkeley, California, business interests and public transit are going head-to-head. Transit planners are looking to install dedicated busways for bus rapid transit along Telegraph Avenue, one of the city's popular shopping streets. But local shopkeepers on Telegraph are trying to block the project, according to a recent article in the San Francisco Chronicle. Opponents have gathered enough signatures to place an initiative on the city's November ballot that would require voter approval for the creation of any high-occupancy lanes within the city. Many see this as an atypical move for Berkeley, which has long been considered one of the most progressive cities in the country. But the shop owners are worried less about their city's reputation than the sustainability of their local businesses. And as they gain support, Berkeley's plans for bus rapid transit may not be coming as rapidly as they'd hoped. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, we'll speak with Steve Barlow at the University Neighborhoods Development Corporation. He has ambitious plans to transform the neighborhoods surrounding the University of Memphis and erase the imagined line that can sometimes separate education institutions from the city it calls home. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Universities often have trouble connecting with the cities they call home, the so-called town gown problem. Our guest, Steve Barlow, aims to change that. He's the executive director of the University Neighborhoods Development Corporation. UNDC is a not-for-profit that is working to revitalize the area around the University of Memphis, the so-called University District, to make it attractive to residents beyond the student body. Steve, describe the neighborhood that surrounds the University of Memphis.
The neighborhood around the University of Memphis is a diverse, very organized community. There is a good bit of diversity in the housing stock. You have everything from low-income apartments, rental houses, entry-level homeowner opportunities, all the way up to the million-dollar dream homes. All in a less than 1 mile radius of the University of Memphis.
Where those that diversity is, in a lot of ways, it's geographically divided, isn't it? I mean, on the north would be the million-dollar homes, and south you have the sort of starter homes, and to the west, I guess, you have more of a some rental units. Would that be about the way it's organized?
It is segmented somewhat like that, although there is a pretty good mix in several of the neighborhoods.
And it's in what I guess I would call East Midtown, which is about how many miles east of downtown Memphis?
I would guess it's within 5 miles.
All right. The university hasn't had a great relationship with its neighbors over the years. What was the source of the conflict?
There has historically been some conflict between the neighborhood and the university administration. However, the president, Dr. Shirley Raines, when she came in 2001, one of her real efforts was to engage the community and to partner with the community in a new and vibrant way. The historical issues, as I understand them, between the university and the neighborhoods that surround it, had to do with, simple disagreements about the future of, certain land uses and the activities of the university and how they would interact with the neighborhood. But the important thing, I think, to point out is that today there is a strong and positive relationship between the university and all of the 6 to 8 neighborhood associations that are so active in the community, to the point of that it is just truly impressive. The university president has an executive assistant whose main job is to connect with the neighborhood groups, the businesses, and to be sure that there's an open dialogue. And you should never expect the university and the communities to agree on everything. Open dialogue has been, I think, part of the reason that there's been such success in recent years in this relationship and in this unique partnership.
What Steve, is any university, not just the University of Memphis, but any university's responsibility to its neighborhood? Or is it really a matter of just simply exercising your self-interest?
I believe that a university that's located in an urban center like the University of Memphis is absolutely has an enlightened self-interest in participating as a member of the community. There are several models nationally, of which actually the University of Memphis is one really good one, where universities have decided that it's time to erase the wall that divides town and gown and begin to embrace their unique role as a significant real estate holder, as a significant provider of brain trust for the community, and as an anchor institution that doesn't plan to go anywhere. The University of Memphis and other universities, other great metropolitan research universities like the University of Memphis, aren't going anywhere. In 100 years, they're still going to be in the same place that they currently do business. And therefore, they have a very strong self-interest, as you state, in having a strong relationship and in interacting in a positive way with the community. And I believe that a revitalization effort such as what we're doing in the Memphis University District, I believe this sort of effort is exactly the way that you begin to achieve a mutual benefit. A good example of that, the University of Memphis, as a part of its master planning process in 2006 and 2007, began to develop a strategy for connecting the entrance of the university towards the Highland Avenue, which is to the west of the main university campus. Around the same time, a prominent local developer who does national mixed-use development approached the university and said, "Hey, what do you think about this idea we have for a 13-acre mixed-use development right on your proposed front door?" Therefore, the University of Memphis and this local developer went to the table together, came up with a plan, and then effectively walked this plan through to get some successful public support and a project which is going to be a hallmark of this exciting new vision for mixed-use, walkable community on Highland Avenue that blends the university's purposes with the community's purposes and creates a vibrant streetscape.
But this project was not, as I recall, without its own controversy. I mean, there were single-family homeowners who would sit even farther to the west of this proposed project who were not terribly excited about the additional density. How did the university and the development corporation handle that opposition?
It's actually a very exciting story. The developer was at first interested in getting some help from the neighborhood-based groups, such as the University Neighborhoods Development Corporation, the University District Incorporated, and the University District Business Alliance. These are the three strong nonprofit organizations that do business in the area and have a strong relationship with the university. All three of these groups talked with the developer very early on and suggested that there be some dialogue with community residents, particularly those you talk about who are directly west of the proposed site, and get some input on the proposed plan. The proposed plan, just so you'll know what we're talking about, is a four-story mixed-use development with 90,000 square feet of retail and restaurant space on the bottom floor and approximately 250 apartment units upstairs for three floors on about a 12-acre site. So that's a little bit on the background. Now, as far as the community meetings, the developer brought copies of plans, was very transparent on the front end. The community groups and the university helped to coordinate meetings for input, and the developer truly listened to the input from the community, and there were several design features that were changed because of that. Much of the opposition was really went away shortly after that series of meetings. The controversial component when we got to the point of seeking public finance had to do, in my opinion, to a great extent on sort of just a misunderstanding in the public about what tax increment financing is. because many people just didn't understand what the impact of a tax increment finance district would be on them as residents who live near the district. For example, a certain residents over and over, they would state that they do not want this development because it's going to cause their taxes to increase. They understood a tax increment finance district to mean that individual resident property taxes would go up to pay for the project. Well, that's absolutely not what a tax increment finance district does. And so I would play the role of educator. And many times I was able to diffuse opposition in that way.
Were you finally, anyone who's done community organizing and community work knows whereof you speak. Did you ever convince this person that he or she had it wrong?
Some people I was successful. Some people I was not. Yes, absolutely. There are still people who are not happy about it. But no one can say that they didn't get an opportunity to get input on it. And no one can say that the developer didn't listen, because there were certain design features actually changed. For example, one series of community meetings, one recommendation was that this was such a great amenity to the community, people didn't want to have to walk all the way around to Highland to get to it. Why couldn't we have some sort of access from Ellsworth, which is the street that runs parallel to the west of Highland Avenue? And part of the design now incorporates a pathway from the neighborhood in. So in my opinion, we were very successful at allowing the community to have a say in what happens on Highland. And the developer had the exact right approach at changing some things, but also realizing and making it clear that they do plan to own this land and do this project, and that this seems to be the right place for it. One other thing I'll add on the process is that, again, this unique community and university partnership, the University of Memphis administration at all levels came to the table to assist this developer to be successful. And they didn't have to do that. They did it because they believe in the future of this neighborhood. The university administration, the president and the provost, have committed to engaging the university with the community in a positive way and helping to bring about change. And again, it comes down, as you mentioned earlier, to an enlightened self-interest. There is strong data to indicate that strong, vibrant real estate market surrounding a university has everything to do with a growth in enrollment, has everything to do with comfort of faculty and parents of students in sending their kids here or in moving to this area.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Steve Barlow. He's executive director of the University Neighborhoods Development Corporation in Memphis, near the University of Memphis. Steve, the school, like many campuses built in the 50s, 60s, 70s, is turned in on itself. Student center with bookstore in the middle of the campus, parking on the edges, not particularly distinguished architecture. If you could wave a wand over the university and turn it into the kind of campus that would be both a good neighbor and stimulate development at its edges, what would you do?
That's a great question, and it's something that we think a lot about in my everyday world. The one way that we're evaluating that exact question is with a partnership of the university's Department of Architecture. The architecture school and the professors in the architecture school have done a series of design studios. The design studios have the senior level architecture students working with local prominent architects and urban designers to think about just such questions. One of the answers that the architecture studio arrived at is to make an effort as planning goes forward and as opportunities arise to build new facilities on campus, is to face, as you said, to face the buildings outwards and rather than inwards. Part of the trend in the, as you said, in the 50s and 60s and 70s in the building of universities was to cluster everything and to face inwards everywhere. And now universities realize that isolates the university from the community. So some of the successful examples around the country include moving the bookstore off campus, encouraging parking that is not only parking for students, but is also parking for the business district. There's one example that I think would be a great idea for the University of Memphis and the community that is on Highland Avenue would be to have some shared parking arrangement between the west edge of the University of Memphis and Highland Avenue, where someone who wants to walk over to a restaurant on Highland could park, or someone who's heading to class could park. So those are the sort of things that we can begin to do to change the perception of a university that is sort of unto itself. Other things, though, Carol, that I think have everything to do with the perception of the university as isolated or not, are these programmatic side, this public face of the university, that what the university calls community engagement strategy. The university is sending out talented faculty and top-tier students to do projects all over Memphis in the areas of expertise of those faculty members. For example, I believe you interviewed someone from the planning school not long ago who did an outstanding urban mapping project with young kids in one of the neighborhoods near the university.
Yeah, that was a great project.
Absolutely outstanding. Now, many, many more examples of that exist. There's a neighborhood in the shadow of the Liberty Bowl where a lot of talk in Memphis has been centered around the fairgrounds and the Liberty Bowl. Well, there's a neighborhood right in the shadow of the Liberty Bowl to the east, and there's an anthropology professor who's running a program over there with students, you know, graduate-level students, to collect community input about what the kids need in that community, what the elder residents who have lived there many decades need and want in their community. This is going to ensure that some residents who live in that neighborhood are a part of the fairgrounds redevelopment process in Memphis. For me, for the University Neighborhoods Development Corporation, the work that they've given me over a series of about four semesters is work I never could have afforded to pay for as a nonprofit organization. But if I did have to pay for it, it would have been a six-figure bill. I mean, these guys came up with beautiful renderings of potential reuses and adaptive design concepts that really give us marching orders going forward. And this all stems from a true commitment to community engagement at high levels at the University of Memphis. Now, I think that over time, things at the university will be moving more and more in the direction of a physical plant that also reflects this engaged strategy. But it does take time to undo those decades of design.
There's a movement, Steve, in some places for retirees to locate close to universities so that they can enjoy the university town atmosphere. Do you think that's an opportunity at all at urban universities like this one?
Absolutely. I think it's a great idea. I think it's an important synergy. We already have a large number of elderly residents in the university district, and one particular development of 40 new condominiums right on the edge of the university where I think elderly folks will be very interested in coming because of the central location and the proximity to the university. Also, there are a lot of benefits on campus for seniors. The ability to audit classes for free, the access, public access to the library, and just the access to the beautiful grounds and the park-like parts of the university. I do believe that it's an important link and part of the philosophy and plan that the University Neighborhoods Development Corporation is focused on is full scope of residential opportunities and business opportunities and educational opportunities in the university district. We are working towards achieving a vision of a place where people can go to school from the time they're in grade school until the time they get a PhD from the University of Memphis, and there would be an appropriate place for them to live at every step along the way. And they're centrally located in a great city and access to this great university surrounded by neighborhoods that are thriving.
Okay, here's a question on the complete opposite end. You may not know this about me, probably don't, but University of Memphis is home to my favorite college basketball team. It's housed on the south side of the campus. Have you thought about how you might leverage proximity to the basketball practice facilities for people who want to live, not necessarily the university life, but are absorbed with basketball?
I think that's a great concept. We should explore that more.
I think you should do a design studio on that one.
That's right. Yes, the Tiger community.
a whole different market, different demographic probably.
You're right. The athletics, is a big part of promoting the University of Memphis, and the proximity to the Liberty Bowl here is a big part of how we think of promoting the neighborhood.
Well, before I let you go, explain to me, just so our listeners will know, the development role that University Neighborhoods Development Corporation plays in all of these kinds of activities that you and I have been discussing.
I think that our role is essentially that what you probably are familiar with is the Main Street model. We're involved in everything from the community organizing, the urban design thinking, the economic development planning, and the promotion of the community. We don't want to be the owner or the developer of anything in this community. What we want to do is serve as a catalyst and serve as the mechanism to remove barriers to moving this forward to be a great community, working in partnership with the university and the community and the city of Memphis. We will remove these barriers and achieve a truly unique opportunity to bring back a walkable, pedestrian-friendly, mixed-use, safe, interesting community life and a community campus environment that everyone wants to come and visit and that people will make that will be a destination.
Well, when you get that basketball community worked out, let me know.
I will.
Okay, Steve, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Steve Barlow is the executive director of the University Neighborhoods Development Corporation. This week, Walker Smith moves away from the mainstream. Our City Views commentator shares a diverse view of the American landscape.
At an accelerating pace, America is becoming a diverse nation. While each of us tends to live in some place that matches our distinctive taste and preferences, all around us, others are finding places like that for themselves. Every place is different, and these differences are growing both in character and number. Difference is the only thing we hold in common as Americans anymore. The melting pot has become a stew. In 1990, minorities made up around one quarter of the U.S. population. By mid-century, they will account for over half. White people, non-Hispanic Caucasians, that is, will no longer be the majority population in America. And this one group, white Americans, will not be superseded by another single group. Whites will be replaced by a diversity of groups. 42% of Hispanics refused to check a box for race in the 2000 census, largely because they did not feel that the census categories included their race. They have a more diverse racial sensibility. People could check more than one box for race in the 2000 census for the first time ever, and nearly 7 million people did so. 54% of these diverse people are under the age of 25. But it's more than race and ethnicity. It's household structure, too. The 2005 U.S. Census American Community Survey reported that married households are now less than half of U.S. households. In 1950, married households were nearly 80% of U.S. households. This one thing, married households, has been superseded by a diversity of things. And it's religion as well. From 1972 to 1993, roughly 63% or so of Americans identified themselves as Protestants. In 1994, it dropped to less than 60% and has been on a steady decline since then. It is barely more than half today, and experts predict that it will soon be less than half. A diversity of religious affiliations is replacing the single dominant Protestant affiliation. The emergence of diversity in America is having far-reaching consequences, especially for politics. The distinguished Emory University political scientist Alan Abramowitz recently wrote about the ongoing impact of the dramatic decline in white, married Christian voters. From over 80% of the electorate in the 1950s to just over 40% today, white married Christians are being superseded by a more diverse electorate. This is bad news for Republicans, for there is no stauncher base of reliable Republican voters than white married Christians. For voters under 30, the percentage of white married Christians has dropped from almost 80% in the 1950s to less than 20% today. As a result of this shift, the 2-to-1 margin that Republicans enjoyed among white married Christians in the 2006 midterm elections was more than offset by the 2-to-1 margin that Democrats enjoyed among the fast-growing diversity of other demographic groups. America's future is indissolubly tied to diversity. The mainstream no longer commands our allegiance and devotion. Instead, we feel permission to be as different as we want to be. The challenge is finding a way forward in which we can all be different together. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is the president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. We'd love to hear from you. Head to our website, smartcityradio.com, and click the contact button. Send us a note about what you like about the show or things we could maybe do a little better. We've had some great story ideas from our listeners that we're working on for future episodes, but let us know what's going on in your city. While you're on the website, you can listen to archived shows, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or subscribe to our podcast. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. He does not want an iPhone, really. I'm Carol Coletta.